Today is March 2nd. It's from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library in the Robeson Pavilion Room, where you can meet some of the candidates who are running for the election, the local offices here. And so the election has begun. Your county clerk is telling you right now that you should come over to 1776 East Washington Street, Monday through Friday, 8 to 4:30, to vote early. We've had about 100 people who have come in so far. We have over almost 2,000 requests for vote-by-mail ballots. You can still do that. Just give us a call, 384-3724, during business hours, or you can go online and request your ballot at www.champaigncountyclerk.com. So check out the website, give us a call, and the elections have begun. April 2nd is the last day to vote, Paul. Call it Election Day, but you've got school board races for Champaign and Urbana. You have the mayoral race in Champaign, three at-large city council seats up in Champaign, Park District, also the Parkland trustees are all on your ballots coming up. So very important stuff. Make sure you get out and cast that ballot.
All right. Okay, I'm already up to a complication here. I can't kick it off with Mumia. We'll have his commentary. I know people have been following it. Larry Krasner, the DA that came in and cleaned house in Philly, was getting pressure from all sides, and he caved to the establishment side, if you will, and is appealing Mumia's retrial. Ruling. So he's supposed to come out with some kind of explanation of the complexities of the implications on other cases of if he were to actually just have acquiesced and say, yeah, why not have a new hearing about this. I've got some John Pilger, I've got some Stephen Cohen. There's so much to talk about, obviously. One thing that I heard on Democracy Now! This week that I followed up on was the great Christine Ong was on this week. She's with a number of groups about Korea, including Women Cross the DMZ, and she's had a recent op-ed in the Times, which I haven't seen yet, with longstanding feminist former CIA person. Gosh, I'm doing a brain fade on her. It's too bad. But she mentioned that there was a GQ article about the Warm Bear case, and she said the author had difficulty getting it published anywhere, so he went to GQ. So I followed that lead and has stuff from the doctor that did the autopsy. And his conclusions were that the brain damage was not indicative of beatings, that it was more like maybe encephalitis or some more widespread. In other words, the damage was widespread through his cerebral cortex. And it wasn't a result of being bashed around. And had a Korean scholar who said, you know, this guy was a bargaining chip, clearly. There's no reason why they would damage the goods, as it were. And that's a pretty cynical approach to things, but then cynicism is rampant. I'm not defending Trump in any regard. I think this was not the worst case outcome for I'm still hoping that the inter-Korean, or if you will, intra-Korean activity will necessitate. Didn't hear anywhere else but on Democracy Now! That Ro Khan had another sense of the House resolution saying that, yeah, we ought to end the Korean War. I've gotten red baited and all sorts of things in the past for talking about Korea, it seems. The forgotten war isn't entirely forgotten. Still not hearing much from a scholar at University of Chicago, who did the foreword for the book by I.F. Stone that was contemporaneous writings about the Korean War. It's a hidden history of the Korean War. Bruce Cummings, it finally came to me. So we're going to kick it off with Amy's take. It talks about the Cohen testimony, if you will, somewhat. And then I'll see if I can find Mumia's most recent commentary, or one of the most recent ones. He's been busy again.
As Black History Month ends, resistance continues against the racist in chief. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Many dared hope after the 2008 election of Barack Obama that the United States could someday enter a post-racial era. The election 8 years later of Donald Trump to the same office demonstrated, sadly, that the scourge of racism is alive and well in America. Trump's profound racism was described by his former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, when he testified before Congress Wednesday. Any attempt to heal the deep wounds of racism that scar this country must include a direct challenge to Donald Trump, our racist in chief.
I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Those are the words of Michael Cohen early in a statement to the House Committee on Oversight and Reform.
The country has seen Mr. Trump court white supremacists and bigots. You have heard him call poorer countries shitholes. In private, he is even worse. He once asked me if I could name a country run by a black person that wasn't a shithole. This was when Barack Obama was president of the United States. And while we were once driving through a struggling neighborhood in Chicago, he commented that only black people could live that way. And he told me that black people would never vote for him because they were too stupid.
Cohen's summary is damning enough, but Trump's record of racism is much longer. NAACP President Eric Johnson said in a statement Wednesday, Trump's presidency and entire career has been an affront to civil rights, so nothing in Michael Cohen's testimony is surprising for a person that has historically racialized and stigmatized those around him. Johnson went on from his racist housing practices to his villainization of the Central Park Five to his birther accusations against President Obama to creating safe havens for white supremacists. All of this maps out the actions and personality of a liar and a racist, Johnson said. The housing discrimination Johnson mentioned refers to a 1973 federal lawsuit against Donald Trump and his father, Fred Trump, for discriminating against African Americans seeking apartments. Beginning in the 1990s, Trump attacked Native Americans, questioning their heritage in his attempts to block tribal casinos that would compete with his failing ventures in Atlantic City. Trump aggressively urged restoration of the death penalty in New York after five youth of color were accused of raping a white woman in the Central Park Five case. All five were imprisoned for years. Later, they had their sentences vacated when the real perpetrator was identified. New York City awarded them over $40 million in damages. Trump, to this day, still insists they're guilty. Donald Trump launched his presidential campaign in 2015 by calling Mexicans murderers and rapists.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
Trump has made the vilification and persecution of Central Americans fleeing violence a pillar of his xenophobic immigration policies, which include building a wall along the southern border. He quickly attempted to implement his Muslim ban and was eventually allowed to enforce a watered-down version of it after the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. A Trump ally on the Oversight Committee, Republican Mark Meadows, had African-American HUD official Lynn Patton, who formerly worked as a party planner for the Trump Organization, stands silently behind him as a living testament that Trump could not be a racist.
Mr. Cohen, do you know Lynn Patton? I'm right here.
Oh, yes, sir.
Do you know Lynn Patton?
Yes, I do.
I asked Lynn to come today in her personal capacity to actually shed some light. How long have you known Ms. Patton?
I'm responsible for Lynn Patton joining the Trump Organization and the job that she currently holds.
Well, I'm glad you acknowledge that, because you made some very demeaning comments about the president that Ms. Patton doesn't agree with. In fact, it has to do with your claim of racism. She says that as a daughter of a man born in Birmingham, Alabama, that there is no way that she would work for an individual who was racist. How do you reconcile the two of those, Mr.
As neither should I, as the son of a Holocaust survivor.
But, Mr. Cohen, I guess what I'm saying is I've talked to the president over 300 times. I've not heard one time a racist comment out of his mouth in private. So how do you reconcile it? Do you have proof of those conversations?
Two new congresswomen of color, Democrats Ayanna Pressley and Rashida Tlaib, both called out Meadows' maneuver. Said Tlaib,
"The fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself."
February is Black History Month, and this year, 2019, marks 400 years since the first Africans kidnapped from their homelands were forcibly brought to North American shores in a life of slavery. Legendary escaped slave and abolitionist Frederick Douglass was born in February of 1818. Malcolm X was assassinated on February 21st, 1965. 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was murdered on February 26, 2012. Our shortest month is devoted to this incredibly long and painful history. This month, we visited the Legacy Museum and Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, with its indoor museum and outdoor lynching memorial. These two sites convey the enormity and sweep of crimes against Africans brought here against their will, and the crimes perpetrated against their African-American descendants. From slavery to Jim Crow and lynching to mass incarceration, this history is portrayed in its stark brutality. But resistance to racism has also been a constant throughout U.S. history. It must be a part of our daily work wherever we find it, whether in our communities, in Congress, or in the Oval Office. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Et amis vers l'humanité, je suis choqué de prendre que l'humanité pourrait disparaître ce quotidien français qui a toujours été la voix des opprimés et de la classe ouvrière depuis plus d'un siècle. Contrairement à la presse bourgeoise, la Humanité et le journal de Pourrières, pour celui des gouvernantes, est-il a toujours donné la priorité à ceux qui se battent pour la liberté, l'émancipation et la dignité. C'est un trésor national et mondial dont l'avenir doit être aussi radieux qu'elle a passé. Moi, comme nous tous, soutenons la humanité. C'est Mumia Abu Jamal.
When the oppressed support the oppressed. In recent weeks, prominent black leaders have been labeled quite unjustly with a tag of anti-Semitism. The best known is perhaps the iconic radical figure Dr. Angela Y. Davis and the brilliant young scholar and author Dr. Mark Lamont Hill. As a direct result of these charges, Davis had an award from a Birmingham, Alabama civil rights group rescinded, and Hill was fired from his post at CNN. At bottom, both were attacked for daring to speak out publicly on behalf of Palestinians and the stark denial of their human rights under Israeli occupation, which raises the obvious question: who has the right to tell one oppressed people when or whether they may support another oppressed people? Few can question the oppression laid upon blacks for centuries in America, which has repercussions into the present that are far too numerous to recount here. Few can honestly question the social deprivation suffered by the Palestinians since the foundation of Israel in 1948, from land confiscations, mass incarceration, and military occupation over Arab villages and communities, and more. Why and how does it become anti-Semitism when communities of the oppressed support each other? When the Obama administration came into power, the U.S. diplomats called on Israel to freeze settlements. Posters sprang up on Tel Aviv walls depicting Obama wearing an Arab headdress called a kafiyeh and emblazoned with the words Jew hater and anti-Semite. This for Barack Hussein Obama, who swore to AIPAC before election to do everything and anything to protect and defend Israel. Neither Angela Davis nor Mark Lamont Hill are anti-Semitic. They are anti-racist, anti-oppression, and anti-imperialist. And no one has the right to tell any oppressed people who they may or may not support. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
C'est seulement une minute en français de Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's got a great accent. I caught a little bit of it. It was kind of hard with all the prison noise, too. The French left and liberals have focused on his case, as they have on many cases of unjust incarceration of African Americans here in the U.S. Always gave refuge to a lot of black intellectuals, too, didn't they? All right. It's not going according to plan, which is why I don't plan so much. Never goes according to plan. I'm going to start out with Steve Cohen. He's a pretty controversial figure. He spoke out with his wife, Katrina Vandehovel, who's the editor of The Nation in the Bay Area recently. KPFA, Flashpoint's undergoing a pledge drive, so I'm sure they would have played a longer segment, but we have a short segment here. Excuse me, with Stephen Cohen. He's been called a Putin apologist and all sorts of things. He's lived over there quite a lot and knows the people who are really being put upon by the authoritarian state. But he has a different view of the origins of the Second Cold War. I think that's the name of his book. And he starts out with a joke. Commend your attention to The Intercepted. I was going to play the opening essay, but maybe we'll hear just a part of it if I can figure out how to excerpt that on the fly. I'll be doing continuity through the afternoon while, we'll be listening to Behind the News, We Do the Work, and Economic Update. Economic Update has stuff on the Mexican strikes. Have you heard about the Mexican strikes? And how the new AMLO regime was cooperative with it? I didn't, so I'll be interested in his analysis of that. We Do the Work is a regular feature, and so I assume that we're hearing part two. I think it's predicated on the retirement of a rather major labor historian who no one has heard of either. So, here is a recent segment from a recent speech by Stephen Cohen. That's Stephen with an A-N, and he's at Columbia and Princeton both, I think, though he's emeritus. And like I said, he's been a skeptic of the Russian collusion. I'm sure he's studied Felix Sater and the dirty money connections, which should have been enough to stop Trump from even being able to run for president. If when Felix Sater flipped the first time, apparently he's flipping now. Trump Soho deal went state's evidence, FBI protection, the whole thing. But I don't think they asked him about the Donald deference to billionaires is sickening in this country. Even when they aren't necessarily billionaires.
Stephen Cohen.
Quite a few people out on a bad night. You all know I'm not Michael Cohen, right? You knew that, right? He's speaking elsewhere, and not tonight. Started writing again for the media, mainly for The Nation, breaking off what I thought was an important scholarly work. I'd been researching in Russian archives for years. I got these cartons of archive documents, and 2014, I was about to attack the cartons, and then Ukraine happened. So I start writing regularly, and that composes this small book that I just brought out, War with Russia? And I got worrieder and worrieder, or I guess you say more worried and more worried. And the context that I had, because of my generation, having lived through the preceding Cold War, is that we were in a new Cold War. I had thought so for about 10 years. But now I thought since 2014, it was more dangerous. And that's the subject I want to talk about tonight. Why, how the Cold War that we're in now is more dangerous than the one that several generations in this room lived through. And I, for the young people who say, gee, Mom and Dad, what was the Cold War like? Now you get to know firsthand. Only this one's more dangerous. So to begin with this discussion, I need to give you a brief definition, though you probably know it already, what is a Cold War. And there are all sorts of relations between states, of course, from war to alliance. You know what that is. But we got to be a little more precise about Cold War. And the definition comes to us from the 20th century. Essentially, it's a relationship in which there's more conflict than cooperation, but usually, not always, usually short of military conflict. So by that definition, there have been other Cold Wars. Soviet Russia and China, you'll recall, had a fairly long Cold War beginning in the 1960s and only began to end in the 80s when Gorbachev came to power. Now it's morphing into an alliance, and there were a few shooting episodes in that Cold War, but it was a classic Cold War, and we waged a Cold War, and maybe still are, against tiny Cuba for decades. So there are other Cold Wars. This is not something specifically Russian and American, but because these two countries are so big and so important in world affairs, it's the American-Russian Cold War that's been the most important in the 20th and 21st century, and so persistent, so repetitive. Think about it like this. We're meeting tonight, roughly, historians like to rough things off, 100 years since the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the onset of the Russian Civil War. During those 100 years, there have been three Russian-American Cold Wars, three, looking back over 100 years. From 1918 to 1933, the United States did not recognize diplomatically Soviet Russia. What could be colder? Somebody buys a house in your neighborhood and you don't talk to them. That's a cold relationship. So that was the first Cold War. It wasn't very consequential for two reasons. We weren't on the same continent, and there was no arms race of any kind. But it was intensely ideological. Then comes Franklin Roosevelt, and we get the corollary of Cold War. Roosevelt recognizes the Soviet Union in 1933, and that is the beginning of the first détente. So détente means trying to, and you know all this, I'm reminding you though of it, because the terms we need again. Détente means a policy of trying to reduce the conflict in Cold War by replacing it with different forms of cooperation. And we had many episodes of détente ever since Franklin Roosevelt. Some very successful, some not so successful. Then the second, in my counting, Cold War began somewhere around 1948, and it lasts 40 years. There's some dispute, as you'll see in about 5 minutes, about when it ended, if it ended, the second Cold War. But it's usually said that it ended either in 1988, 1999, with Reagan and Gorbachev, or with Gorbachev and Bush in 1990, 91. And that long Cold War, 40 years, had three episodes, I just remind you, I know you know this, of detente. Eisenhower with Khrushchev. Some of you remember, some of you read about it. Then comes the famous Nixon-Kissinger detente with Brezhnev, and the most successful detente of all, Reagan with Gorbachev, when the two leaders claim, and we may wonder if it was so, that they had actually ended Cold War forever in 1988 and 1999. Now, by my reckoning, a third Cold War ensued. Lots of people don't agree with me, but the facts are facts. When did it begin? I would date it from toward the end of the Bill Clinton presidency in the 1990s, when Clinton made two fateful decisions. First, to expand NATO to Russia's borders. He didn't get it all the way to Russia, but it's right on Russia's borders now, in the Baltics, in Ukraine, conceivably they're attempting in Georgia, in the Caucasus. So it is right on, NATO's right on Russia's borders now. And secondly, Clinton's decision to bomb Serbia in 1999. Serbia being Russia's kind of sentimental, orthodox, traditional little brother. And that, I think, is the beginning of the third Cold War. Now, this 100 years leaves us with some questions, and I can't answer all of them. And so I'm just going to leave them with you. You think about it. And if you're students, you might ask your professors who teach this history for their answers. Why have 75 years, if you added up 1918 to 1933, then 1948 to 1940, that's 4070, plus whatever we have to now, why have 75 years of 100 years of American-Russian relations been Cold War? 75 years out of 100, roughly. Now, some would say that it's the fault of Soviet communism and its legacy. That's what caused this Cold War. There are some anchors on MSNBC who think Putin's a communist, but he's an anti-communist. They've actually said he's a communist, but they're confused, or behind the times, or ahead of the times, but not accurate. But some say it's communism and its legacy. But since 1991, with the end of the Soviet Union and President Yeltsin of Russia, post-Soviet Russia, officially the Kremlin has been anti-communist. Not indifferent, not agnostic, but Putin is professedly an anti-communist. And indeed, for that matter, a man of the Orthodox Church. Dangerously so, maybe. Last week, he embraced the Church in even more expansive ways. But he's certainly not a communist. So another explanation might be, and Putin being an anti-communist, then it raises the question, is Cold War the normal, whatever normal means, inherent, intrinsic relationship between America and Russia? There's just something about our political cultures that make us eventually resort back to Cold War. It's possible, but I'm not sure. So that brings me to the question, which is part of an answer, that I ask tonight, who and what is to blame for this new Cold War that I see beginning in at least in the late 1990s? Now, if you go to a library, and I don't do it very often anymore because I'm working at home, but if you go to a library and you look under the subject, Histories of the Cold War, meaning the 40-year Cold War, you will find an enormous literature, literally scores of books. And it's a pretty decent literature. And if you read it, you'll discover that the authors, both historians, political scientists, and participants who've written memoirs, give you a fairly balanced picture of responsibility. That most of the quality literature says that both the United States and the Soviet Union, to some degree, they apportion various degrees, but to some degree were responsible for the 40-year Cold War. That seems sensible to me, and that's what we want to take away from that, that both sides were responsible. But if the new Cold War has been underway 20 years now, there's a pretty sizable literature on this Cold War, too. And if you look at it, it blames only one side, Russia. There is almost no literature, a little, but certainly no mainstream literature, blaming the United States. And this is quite striking because a lot of this literature is written by scholars. And in short, it says, it dates it from about 2001 or 2 or 3, blames it on Putin personally. So the short answer is, in this literature, Putin caused the new Cold War. We were benign. We tried to help post-Soviet Russia. Putin comes along, spoils everything. End result, new Cold War. My interpretation, and it's not one that you can find, or for that matter, get into the mainstream media today, is, as Russians would say, naоборот, it was the United States that caused this new Cold War. That the opportunity to end Cold War, which, depending on your reckoning, Gorbachev, Reagan, Bush gave us back then, nearly 30 years ago, was lost not in Moscow, but in Washington. So if you were going to write a history of this explanation, and as a historian, I think historically, but there is no such book that does this explanation the way I'd like to see it done, and I'm not going to write it. Let me just give you the headlines or the milestones of what I would call the American-instigated new Cold War. So it was begun, and maybe made inevitable in some ways, by a revision of the peace terms on which the Cold War was ended with the Soviet Union in 1988, 89, or 90. All the major participants, and you can look this up, back then, that would mean Gorbachev, President Reagan, Bush, all the Europeans involved, German, French, British, agreed at the time, take yourself back to say 1990, that the Cold War had ended through negotiations with, and every one of them used this expression, without any losers or winners. Both sides had won. It had been a bad thing. Both sides had come to their senses. It was over. There were no victors, no losers. And it was in that spirit that Gorbachev, in 1990, made a historic decision. He agreed not only to the reunification of Germany, but since the Cold War was over, he agreed to a united Germany being in NATO. That was a very hard sell back home in the Soviet Union, which had lost 27.5 million citizens during World War II. But he did it, because he assumed that this was true, that the Cold War was over, and fine, nobody wanted Germany out on its own, that's the backstory, so let's stick it in NATO and keep it under control. What then happens? The first President Bush completely rewrites the terms of the Cold War peace agreement, completely rewrites them. Behind Bill Clinton in 1992, in his re-election struggle, Bush suddenly says America won the Cold War. And he dates it not from the negotiations of 1988-89, but from the end of the Soviet Union in 1991. That is, he conflates the end of the Cold War with the end of the Soviet Union. This is a completely different history, completely different, with a different causality. So, having done this, Russia becomes, in this new narrative, which I call the American triumphalist narrative, we won the Cold War, Russia becomes a defeated nation, kind of like Germany and Japan after World War II. This becomes axiomatic. I got, last count, 4 grandkids of different ages. I looked at all their textbooks on this subject. They all say America won the Cold War. It's part of the post-Soviet American narrative, this triumphalist saga. And it is a false saga. I mean, false not in lying, but it's historically inaccurate. It's not what happened. But it becomes triumphalistic and part of American foreign policy. So you see it at work with Clinton in the 1990s. He talks friendship and partnership with Yeltsin, the first post-Soviet president of Russia, but in fact, they're treating Yeltsin very, very badly. I won't go into the story, but if you want to know what really happened, his Russia hand, Strobe Talbot, wrote some memoirs called The Russia Hand. And it's pretty ugly stuff, with Clinton saying to Talbot, Clinton in public saying Yeltsin's his dearest friend, I guess we'll have to shove some more dish up old Boris's mouth tomorrow. I mean, they were dictating to Yeltsin what was going to be. It wasn't wise. But they thought Yeltsin would never end. It was certainly a decision, a factor, in Clinton's decision to expand NATO. That decision was made during the Clinton administration.
And that was Stephen Cohen speaking recently with Katrina Vandenhoevel, the publisher of The Nation magazine, got an important new book and gave a speech, came to town and gave a very strong speech. And we are...
And I was... preparing for the rest of the afternoon and didn't pull up Stephen Cohen's new book name. I think he gave it, so if you were listening closer than I was, you probably... Oh, War with Russia, question mark. Controversial scholar, Stephen Cohen. And, yeah, I thought that was a funny joke at the beginning. Going to go on with Australian-born John Pilger. He had a Consortium News publication just recently about Venezuela, where he did a lot of film work. He's a filmmaker. I don't know what you call people anymore. It's not on film, but, well, it's a film of reality that we look at. Momentarily, I'll start that up. I didn't pull up any PSAs. You heard about the meet and greet for Champaign voters. Maybe you want to meet some of them, even if you're an Urbanite or an Environs person. Hope the people are listening from out in the boonies. That's where I first listened to community radio, from a very small town in southern Illinois, listening to the Gaslight Square station, KDNA. There's no KDNA, there is a KDHX, and there's no Gaslight Square anymore either. Okay, 22 minutes, that's going to be a wrap. So if you want to hear some Intercepted, go to it. Charlie Savage talking about unitary executive theory and what we can expect from our AG, Mr. Barr, from what his writings were and what he attested at Congress, and if the twain meets. Opinions you hear are those of speakers, not necessarily shared by others. As I mentioned, economic update coming up. There's a hour interview, which is not the usual format for Behind the News. That's coming up directly next. And then there's We Do the Work. And then I think Denise Alter Ego will be in doing continuity at 1 o'clock. And I'm lapsing on what that programming is. Perhaps you can call and tell me. It's rotating shows, so maybe that's why I don't recollect. And without further ado, this will pretty much close out. We'll have a little extra time. There's some musical events around town, notably Almost Day. Dorothy Monterano's gracing the stage today. And I guess by popular demand, it says that Morgan Powell with his trombone will be adding some flourishes and highlights. And I'm going to ask George Turner if he's getting laid off at Macomb. There have been draconian cuts at Western, perhaps with a look to Springfield for some bailout. Extremely large number of layoffs there. It's not a big school to start with. And the jazz program is probably going to take the brunt of it, as happens here.
Award-winning, I'd say legendary filmmaker, many films, many crucial films, starting early on monitoring the multiple horrors caused by U.S. policy, aggressive policy, policy guided by weapons and greed. And it continues now, John Pilger, in Venezuela. We saw a very interesting encounter over the weekend at the border. I'm reading and enjoying your piece, although I'm gritting my teeth as I read your piece about sort of how the Bolivarian Revolution made a difference to Venezuela, and how from the get-go it made Americans angry that they lost control over this resource-rich country that they considered, in the U.S. considers in its backyard in the context of the Monroe Doctrine, and has the right to, you know, do whatever it wants. You want to sort of set the scene. How are you angry about what's going on? Are you inspired by the resistance? Talk about this.
Well, I've ceased being angry, I think, Dennis, although it does come up now and then, I must admit. Let's say I'm more incredulous when I read that Elliot Abrams, a man responsible for so much suffering in that part of the world, has been appointed in this imperial envoy's role as the, I think, what is he, the envoy to Venezuela. But putting him aside...
Special. He's a very special envoy.
Very special. Venezuela is very different, as all, of course, all the Latin American countries are, in their common heritage, but very different from others, in that its association with the United States is probably, with the exception of the old Cuba, the closest. And for a very long time, the middle and upper class of the ruling elite in Venezuela had regarded themselves almost as dual nationals, as Venezuelans and Miamians. That's where their banks were. And when I filmed in Venezuela some years ago and had a certain amount of entree to these people, what struck me immediately was their likeness to the South African white class. For one thing, racism was such an issue in Venezuela for them, because the majority were not, as this class saw themselves as, white, and they weren't always white, but they saw themselves as white and close to North America. Their compatriots, the majority of their compatriots, were not white. They were mestizo, and black, and Afro-Venezuelans, and, of course, of whom Hugo Chavez was one of them. And it was he who brought back a pride, let's say a racial pride, to the majority of his people, who had been regarded with, I would say, racial contempt by those who are now, today, at the core of what the Western media calls the opposition. They aren't the whole opposition. There are real grievances in Venezuela, of course. But those commanding these grievances and manipulating them represent that white supremacist class that dominated, that has dominated and still dominates that country. And one could criticize Chavez for a number of things, and certainly one of them was that the economic power of this class was never really interfered with. I think that was the great fault of the Chavistas, that they left big capital and with all its North American underpinnings, they left it in place in Venezuela. And that has produced this intensely polarized country and the absurd situation. And it is absurd that this man, Guaido, could declare himself the president. I was reading in The Nation not long ago that, according to a fairly reliable survey, 81% of the Venezuelan people had never heard of this man. He'd never been elected. And here he was, not only declaring himself president, but being declared president by a foreign power, by the United States, which in turn was backed by other foreign powers in Europe and in Australia. So much for this wondrous independence of the European Union that so many in Britain still want to be part of, how they capitulated to this grotesque absurdity of recognizing a colonial, almost a colonial pop-up creature. I mean, this man was... is a sort of manufactured by the National Endowment for Democracy, which was invented in the 1980s as a front for the CIA and has conducted its so-called color revolutions all over the world, from Ukraine to Latin America. He was given the get-go by Vice President Pence. I mean, this is also regressive. It sounds like it's sometimes, you mentioned, was I angry? I was incredulous, really, Dennis, that this can... happening in 2019.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are delighted to be joined by filmmaker John Pilger, Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, incredibly important investigative reporter and filmmaker. And we're talking about, the United States' active attempt to destabilize and once again put its hooks into Venezuela, undermining the Bolivarian Revolution, which, as you point out in your piece that's up now on Consortium News, was about empowering the majority, which were brown and black people, and that racism reigned supreme until the Bolivarian Revolution was instituted. And from the get-go, the U.S. attacked, went after Hugo Chavez because of this, and went after Maduro. They've been a little bit, I guess, more effective with Maduro, but this is what we're seeing, right, John?
Yeah. Well, it's ironic, isn't it, that identity politics is so much all the rage in the liberal press and in so-called liberal politics in the United States, and in many respects, rightly so. But the issue of race doesn't apparently extend past the shores of the United States, because of race and class are the key issues in Venezuela. As I mentioned, if this was South Africa, perhaps we'd have a different kind of reporting, but I don't get a sense from the New York Times, Washington Post, and all the rest of them that they describe these divisions and how these divisions have been reinforced in Venezuela and the importance of the Chavista time was to liberate the majority of the people on the basis of class and race. The same thing happened in Bolivia, where people of mixed race were even banned from coming anywhere near the country's National Assembly in La Paz. Now they control it. This is people power. And although people power, in my view, didn't go anywhere near far enough in Venezuela, it left in place the very, very powerful class, and that mistake, if you like, is now reaping what we're seeing in Venezuela. But it did give people, it did in the most impoverished continent, in the most colonized continent, in the most let's say alienated and disaffected continent, Latin America, it did give people a chance to rise to their proper state of human dignity. And Chavez's legacy should always be remembered for that. And although Maduro is different, it's a different situation, but the Chavistas are still the majority in that country. Although we don't see their massive demonstrations on the news. The BBC reporter, Ola Guerin, tweeted that it was just too difficult to do two demonstrations in one day, so she did the opposition demonstration, which, of course, they turn out a lot of people too. But it gives the impression that these are the great mass of Venezuelan people rallying against the government. It's a very important situation. The good news is, Dentist, that these, how shall I call them, extreme Orientalists, and that's being polite about Trump and Pence and Abrams and the rest of the gang, are not winning. Even their Lima group of countries that they thought they had on board have rejected outright any plans to militarily intervene in Venezuela. And crucially, Spain has said, I think yesterday, that we'll have nothing to do with this. So the world is now, as the Maduro government bats off this phony humanitarian aid stunt on its borders, the world is now starting to see, I think, something of the real face of this assault on this latest assault on a Latin American country. It's actually the 68th attempt by the United States to overturn a government.
That's 68 times.
68 times. I quote the much missed Bill Blum, who died recently, whose wonderful books documented the number of times the United States had intervened in countries around the world. This is the 68th. And yet we have to put up with day after day this not Russiagate nonsense, for which there is no evidence, not the sort of evidence that would stand up in any reasonable court of law. No evidence. We have to put up with this nonsense about Russia meddling in U.S. elections when, I wouldn't use the term meddling, the U.S. has been assaulting other countries, overturning electoral results, overturning democratic governments for as long as I can remember.
Let's just deconstruct for a moment what happened this weekend. We're hearing from the UN Rapporteur on Human Rights for Venezuela, who visited the country, that this so-called humanitarian aid is what he calls, I guess, weaponized humanitarian aid. You want to just deconstruct this? The way the corporate press, the Rachel Maddows of the world, here is the brutal Venezuelan government attacking the U.S. for wanting to bring necessary food to save the lives of Venezuelans. And here you've got the former Iran-Contra criminal pardoned by the current attorney general, who's about to pardon whoever he needs to pardon. This is a textbook case of a violent dictator brutalizing his country, starving them, turning away human aid, human rights observers and aid.
Yeah. Dennis, sure, as they say, yours is a family show, so I can't use one word that sums up what all that is. And I, you know, as Julius Nyerere, the former president of Tanzania, once said, we get so much American nonsense. We get so much about American elections. Can we please all be American citizens, if only to vote out their terrible people? And I paraphrase him, I have to say, but that's what this comes down to. And we have these overpaid, overhyped, under-talented people in the American media telling the world how to think. What they say is propaganda of such a pure kind that they're just simply lies. Professor Stephen Cohen, the world-renowned authority on the Soviet Union, had a very interesting comment on this. He feels that the United States is being actually Sovietized. That is that lying, official lying, and media lying and propaganda and witch hunting. Selective witch hunting is becoming so common now that there's a sense of the Soviet Union during its darkest period, when critics were picked off, when propaganda, those who went against the propaganda were witch hunted, and the chief propagandists, of course, ruled. And they rule in the United States today, many of them in the so-called liberal media. So I think that's quite interesting to think about that. I mean, there are huge differences, of course, but there is an aspect of that.
I just have to throw this one out. What we're seeing in the U.S. is we've had an election here, and there were a number of very interesting young people and folks who don't look like the typical folks elected to Congress in the U.S. And some of them call themselves socialists. So now you got the Democrats saying, using, piling on, supporting the overthrow of the duly constituted Venezuelan governments, and saying, look, you young whippersnappers, you want socialism? You want... And we got the so-called liberals playing this card.
There's another layer there, Dennis. None of them are socialists. And we have some of the most hyped of them now stepping into line. They stepped into line right from the beginning. Senator Bernie Sanders distinguished himself by calling some time ago Chavez a dead communist dictator. All I can say is these people who are now trying to dignify what are basically liberal policies, and good for them, liberal policies with the term socialism, have some very interesting programs, domestic programs for the United States, but they have the same orientalist, the same imperialist view of the rest of the world. And that is the litmus test, surely, the way the United States regards the rest of the world, because at the moment the U.S. is a common enemy to many, many countries around the world with its sanctions and its wars and its threats and its intimidations. And these people have a duty to speak out about that, but they're not, none of them. At least I haven't read of any.
There's nothing going on. They continue
calling themselves socialists. So I suppose that's a new brand, is it? That's a brand that can be used. They're not socialists. They're members of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has started more wars than the Republican Party in my lifetime. So there's a long way to go.
Wow. Well, we always like having the opportunity to spend some of that long road together with you, John Pilger, my favorite filmmaker. And how are you doing on your latest film? That's about healthcare.
It is. It's going well. It'll have an American component.
You mean what not to do if you want to save?
There may be an element of that, yes, but there's some very interesting people in the United States, good people who have struggled hard for a decent universal healthcare system. And so I hope to be talking to them this year, and the film will be released at the end of the year.
We are looking forward to that. Again, we thank you so much, John Pilger, for spending this time with us. Take care now.
Always a pleasure, Dennis.
Always a pleasure. Bye-bye. And not only a pleasure, but always enlightening to have John Pilger, whose film started in Vietnam, ripping the lid off of one imperialist disaster after another. What did he say? 68 overthrows that were attempted by the United States government. 68 overthrows.
And how many were quote-unquote successful? John Pilger, when I posted the consortium articles on the Facebook, I mentioned that you can find an article by him, John Pilger, about the somewhat quote-unquote constitutional coup was done through the Governor General and the power of the Queen to dissolve the Parliament in Australia in the early 70s, putting an end to Labour. Their Labour Party, Gough Whitlam, G-O-U-G-H, I don't know really how to say that. I think the G is spelled, is pronounced like an H, sort of like Dutch. Whitlam, I believe that's right. He was deposed by the Governor General, and re-elections happened, and he was a close Labour percentage, and they lost, and he had the temerity to want to close the CIA listening station in Australia and do other things that weren't entirely compliant to the U.S. Role. So that's probably one of the 68 that Australian born, now living in U.K., John Pilger would cite, since he wrote a whole short article about it. I don't know if there's a book-length study of that phenomena. Well, got a little time to play with. Maybe there'll be a little music at the end of Behind the News, since it's running 52 minutes. That counts for KPFA's, its host station, though he lives in Brooklyn. Their news segment, generally about 6 or 8 minutes long, that they do out of their own news bureau. I've got a little underwriting announcement to read here. But first, I'll mention that opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily shared by others at the station. A WEFT Associates meeting, new location since the Civic Center. I guess this is part of the decline of the civic culture. Is closed, I think. I don't know whether anybody's repurposing that or tearing it down or doing something with it. Community United Church of Christ on campus, 805 South 6th Street. I don't know how people feel about going to campus, but it's 7 in the evening, so parking is more available. It's in the Fellowship Hall in the basement. I guess this will be the venue for meetings. There are two locations that I've got access to there. The 2019 fund drive begins March 26th. I think last week in Gina's absence, I was supposed to play a little thing that talked about that. But, oh well, I'll mention it now. It kicks off on a Tuesday, which is probably a good day of the week to do it, on Kevin Elliott's Joshua Tree Inn. Name from when Jay Rosenberg did some radio down here, did folk and Americana.